This is, as it is every week, the Regeneration Podcast. Michael Martin has 6 more inches of snow, about 10, 15 more chickens than I do. And he's got, no matter how many cows he has, mine are 0. So he's got many more. How are they all doing?
They're okay this weather. Cows don't like the wind. So they today it's windy, so they don't want to go out of the barn. But
yeah.
But good.
This is our first frozen ground of the year here in upstate New York. The first frozen ground. And our guest, I think since I've been reading his blog, our guest today, John Michael Greer, I think tell me if I'm right, Michael Greer, and Michael's going to read more of a bio of you, that you live in Winchester, Virginia now, but previously you might have been like in Vermont or something?
No, I live in Rhode Island. Previously lived in Western Maryland and Southern Oregon and Seattle. I've ever been to Winchester, Virginia, although I'm sure it's a pleasant place.
Yeah, so I'm glad I didn't do any official bio. I gave disclosure. I guess you don't talk about where you live all the time in your excellent blog, Info Sophia, formerly the Arch Druid Report, and we'll have you kind of describe more of that. But Michael, give a little bio on our friend.
Yeah, well, so everything with me starts with the story, right? So, a few years ago, I don't know how long ago, Mike, you and quite a few other people kept saying, do you know John Michael Greer? Do you know his work? I said, I know the name. And so they've directed me to your blog, and I found a kindred spirit right here. And my gosh, he calls his blog is now called Echo Sophia, right? So this is my tribe. Now then I started looking into your work, and I realized that I've known about you for a long time, because I remember seeing your books on, I think you have books on magic, on runes, and all kinds of things. And so John Michael Greer is, in addition to being the former Archdruid of North America, a group he's still affiliated with, I believe, he's also an astrologer, and he writes, I think, one of the more interesting blogs on the internet, Echo Sophia, as I just mentioned. And he's always writing about things that I'm interested in. So recently he's been talking about the myth of disenchantment, but also he had a really good one on an interesting period that I'm really interested in history is the occult revival of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, which, as John Michael said recently, nobody talks about. And it's important. It's a supremely important movement in Western history, and especially more recent history. So, John Michael Greer, we just want to welcome you to the show. And thanks for being here.
Well, thank you very much for having me here. I'm a pleasure to be on.
And so to start, well, one of the things we told you we wanted to talk about, and one of your books that I love quite a bit is The Retro Future. Mm-hmm. And because so many of the things resonated with my own experience, as Mike was saying earlier, I'm living a biodynamic farm here, a mm-hmm. little tiny place in Michigan, and we use almost zero machinery other than hand mm-hmm. tools on our farm. Mm-hmm. And we're connected to a community of people who are interested in raw milk and interested in alternative modes of healing and things like this. Mm-hmm. And through that, we're connected to right maybe a mile away from our house is it's called the Waterloo Farm Museum, where they have, mm-hmm. Reenactment kind of demonstrations a couple times a year. And so you go to talk to people, learn how to, blacksmiths, people who do tanning of skins or whatever it happens to be, shearing sheep. But as you point out in that book, that's a real thing, and those are useful skills for mm-hmm. what you see as coming down the line, which mm-hmm. is the retro future. So I wonder if you could tell our listeners what you mean when you say the retro future.
Okay. Let's start with some unspeakable utterances, something that, the sort of thing you would imagine H.P. Lovecraft putting into one of his stories of cosmic horror. The unspeakable thing I want to talk about here is the fact that progress is a mythology. Mm-hmm. Okay. Does it happen from time to time? Yes. But there is no law of nature that requires progress to continue. And in fact, if you look through the cycles of history past, you find that every civilization rises to a certain level of technical complexity and then declines again. You lose complexity, you lose the very high-end skills because you don't have the economic basis to support them, and so on and so forth. It is an article of faith in our society today that that can't happen to us. Maybe it happened to all these clever, sophisticated, complex societies of the past, but we're better than that.
Yeah.
I have bad news for people who believe that. I would encourage them to notice that, well, among other things, was it Calvin Trillin, I think, commented that the words computer upgrade or program upgrade are probably the most frightening in the English language. Mm-hmm. Because you know that that upgrade is going to cost more, do less, cause more problems than each one that come, than whatever program you had before it.
Right.
This is the nature of an over-complex technology. And so what inevitably happens in the twilight of a civilization, such as we're going through right now, is that the extremely complex technologies that civilization developed at its peak begin to break down. They become dysfunctional. They cost more than they're worth. The problems spin out of control. And you have to go back to a somewhat simpler mode of technology. Now, this does not mean going back to the caves, the strange attractor that draws the imagination of the modern world. Everybody thinks, well, if we're not using the latest, hot, up-to-date, blah, 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 it's back to the caves or back to the Dark Ages, two things about which the people in question usually know absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. No, what we're talking about is downshifting to a slightly less or a somewhat less complex technology. Let's say going from the technologies that we're using today to the technologies we used all the way back in the 1980s. I was alive in the 1980s. Right. I remember them. We were not living in caves and beating dinosaurs over the head with rocks, okay?
It was okay.
it sometimes felt that way, but no, we actually led tolerably civilized lives. I dimly remember the 1960s, and we actually, in a lot of ways, had better lives in those days.
Yeah.
And so what we're looking at in terms of the retro future is recognizing that you can make technology too complex. You can put too much resources, become too dependent on too much intricacy, too much centralization, and it doesn't work. So what do? You back off a little bit. You go down the ladder a couple of steps to the next step, the highest step that's stable. And there you can, again, it's stable. You can stabilize things. You don't have to go all the way back to the bottom. You can say, okay, what's a technology that will work? What's a technology that will fill the needs we have at this place at this time with this resource base that we've got? Mm-hmm. And so that's what my book, The Retro Future, is about. It's focusing on, let's get out of the mythology of progress. Let's stop fantasizing about Tomorrowland. Let's please, give flying cars and the rest of that fantasy island stuff a decent burial.
The flying cars. It's always brought up. It's just a theme in your writing. It's just great.
Yeah, it's because I get it all the time. When I was first writing on Peak Oil back in the days of the Archdruid Report, people were constantly going, you're crazy. We're going to have flying cars any day now. And I would point out to them, the first flying car was invented in 1917. It worked, too.
Yeah, yeah.
We were at
the beach one time, and my brother had a young son, and he buried a letter. He just buried it so far deep that his younger son could find and pretend he found something from an old sailor or something. But my brother, in writing that letter, said, hi, my name is so-and-so. Flying cars have not been invented yet. Things like that. And so, I was probably reading your blog at the time, and there's just flying cars capture so much of the mindset that leads to this iatrogenesis, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, the thing is, and flying cars are one of those things, a fundamentally stupid idea on so many levels. Mm-hmm. If you're an engineer, you know perfectly well that cars require certain things in an engine. Planes require entirely different things in an engine. If you combine the two, you get something that doesn't do either one well. So you can pay a huge amount of money to have a lousy car that's also a lousy plane, or you can take the same money, buy a Lamborghini, buy a really good light plane, and probably have enough left over for a yacht. So, and then there's the question of, okay, flying cars, great. What happens the first time we get a 20-car pileup on the way home from work? You have flaming chunks of debris and human bodies falling from the sky. What a lovely idea.
Yeah. There's a
but nobody thinks about
it. Name who says, you know, the invention of the car was the invention of the first car wreck. The invention of the train. Yeah, it's just you're kind of singing in that musical register.
Exactly. But you have to say, okay, how would this actually work? This is the question nobody's asking. With the flying cars and all the other crap that fills the sort of Tomorrowland imagination. No, let's stop. Let's say, okay, our goal here, at least in theory, is to have decent lives, to have the capacity to meet human needs and wants in a reasonable and a reasonable manner, in a way that can be sustained over the long term. Okay, that's a marvelous goal. How about we figure out what level of technology will do that best? It may not be the bells and whistles and high-tech Tomorrowland stuff.
Well said.
Right. And I think that's an important thing. You point to, you know, technology was made for man, not man for technology. You know,
mm-hmm.
so resizing. Our technology to the human needs and flourishing, mm-hmm. not to the flourishing of the technocracy.
I've told mm-hmm. people that, like, the monastery that I worked at, John, we really reflected the same thought. So I worked at a Trappist monastery running a retreat house mm-hmm. for about 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not in the rule of Saint Benedict, but what they do is they say, they look at technology and see if it can be monasticized. And mm-hmm. what that means is very similar to the social critic Ivan Illich's use of convivial mm-hmm. tools, that the mm-hmm. monks looked at tools and said, does this help community, or do they work as a toxin and a solvent on all the bonds of community? Mm-hmm. So, like, TV mm-hmm. lasted a day. You know, they got in there, they fired the bad boy
good
up.
Good for the monks.
Yeah, mm-hmm. they looked around and they saw all these kind of blank stares, and then it went into the closet to come out on 9/11 and probably John Paul II's death.
Mm-hmm.
And Ivan Illich is kind of saying the same thing. You know, he used the word conviviality. And I like the two things can be happening at once. I really love your image of kind of the baseline going back a few rungs of the ladder. And during that mm-hmm. time going back a few rungs, we might have a civil conversation, imagine that, about tools mm-hmm. that we helped build community and tools that we thought, you know, again, acted as dissolvents on community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly it. We need the mythology of progress is, among other things, a marketing gimmick. The whole point is that, you know, big corporations vie to have their technology defined as the next step in progress, and once it's the next step in progress, of course, everyone has to run out and get it. Mm-hmm. And that's just marketing. There is no next step in progress. Progress is, you know, there is no internal dynamic of progress. And so instead we can say, no, we don't want that crap. Mm-hmm. We don't want that new technology. We'll pass on Windows 10. It sucks. And Windows 11, let's not even talk about it. we don't need smartphones. The number of people who are ditching their smartphones at this point and going back to quote, dumb phones, to flip phones, basically, or like me, don't have a cell phone at all.
That's great. Yeah.
I mean, I'm having this conversation on a landline. I shoveled some coal into the boiler and got up a good head of steam before I called. So.
Wow. Great.
Yeah. In fact, you're reminding me of it just before we started recording. I was reading this old book by H.J. Massingham called The Wisdom of the Fields.
Mm-hmm.
And his first chapter is on William Cobbett.
Mm-hmm.
And who William Cobbett was actually making similar statements 300 years ago or 200 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, the thing is, people figured out very early in the Industrial Revolution that what was going on and what was being sold as what was going on were two completely different things.
Right.
The Industrial Revolution was not this grand step forward. It's simply an over-centralization of wealth and power in too few hands.
Exactly.
We didn't have to go that way. We don't have to go that way. And now that it's falling to bits, it's time for us to begin again, stepping down the ladder a few rungs and finding a place where we can stabilize ourselves before the rung we're on falls out from underneath us.
Yeah.
Because it will.
If we stay on progress for a little bit, I think there's a tie-in with your current series of essays, because we really want to draw people to your blog too. Not for you, but for us, for the world. You know, if they're reading you, they're able to think outside the box. But your current, as Michael said, it's dealing with what you would call, John, the you know, the myth of enchantment and so forth. And you can describe it a little bit. But you're taking, you know, headlong, you're hitting progress in the face there again too. In our own, Michael and I both have a dance going with the Catholic Church. You know, it's, sometimes it's a good dance, quite often it's a horrible dance. But anyhow, we speak that argo pretty well. And John Paul II actually called the myth of progress as the greatest, you know, mythology of our time. And yet, I want to put, you know, your great insights into progress, because you're also in your most recent essay talking about Ken Wilber, the belief, you're tying the myth of progress to the evolution of consciousness. And I wonder if we could, you know, for me, I almost wonder if I could separate the two a little bit, that maybe not in Wilber's, but in Steiner's and Owen Barfield's. And I know you're talking to two people who are familiar with them, but we're not those people who think they're gods by any stretch of the imagination.
Thank you. I find Barfield and especially Steiner very worth study, very worth attention to, but the cult of personality that is built up around Steiner, the sort of fundamentalist Steiner said it, I believe it, that settles it notion, frankly, that is the major obstacle in the way of people paying attention to what to the serious achievements that Steiner had. People get 100% turned off by that fundamentalism. So, you know, it's really unfortunate. It's really unfortunate.
So if the notion of progress, if both Steiner, and I'm reading a guy, Gerald Hurd, right now, who's also dealing with the evolution of consciousness, and he was frankly a new name to me, and I find him to be quite brilliant. But if you look at Steiner, you know, you could see in one sense there's a belief in progress there, but it involves, you know, it wouldn't rule out the insides of Oswald Spengler. And it also, you know, it also has its, they would consider like a descent, you know, where we are now, where we had individualized consciousness and we're not getting out of it. Almost apocalypse. So though I agree with you, this myth of inevitable progress is, you know, it's one of the greatest foes of clear thinking that we can deal with possibly. But this, you know, that with, you can look at somebody like Steiner or again, Gerald Hurd, and you can, Gerald Hurd uses Oswald Spengler, that history has these cycles and it doesn't inevitably go up, but there's this poetry from like, as you know, from kind of constellated consciousness to an individuation that's supposed to go to this greater symphony of where the one remains unique, and it's also involved in like a womb-like oneness. And there's a paradox there. But we find that, again, I say, we find it in Western classical music. You know, if you and I went to the Philharmonic, you're going to see that same basic pattern from original harmony through discord and discord being woven up. And and I think, you know, when we look at Barfield, it's not so much saving the appearances, which makes it all theoretical, but it's almost the empiric work he's done in books like The History of English Words and so forth, right? Where he does find this kind of consciousness taking a pattern and like tacks it along. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, there's certainly a pattern here, but it's more complex in a number of ways than Barfield in particular was really able to grasp. Barfield is at his best when he's dealing with the society that he knows, when he's dealing with European and especially British society and its evolution. History in English Words is a great example, where he's taking, you know, this these words along their arc from from the consciousness of the Dark Ages, from what he would call original participation, and what I would call a state of enchantment, into the disenchanted, idolatrous, in his term, consciousness of the present.
Yep.
Now his he's really good at that. Now where he falls on his nose is that he does not know as much as he thinks he knows about other cultures and about prehistory. Partly he was frankly hamstrung by the extremely poor ethnographic ideas of you know, ethnographic studies of his time, which were all lumping all non-Western cultures together into primitive man. You know, I was stopped at the phrase primitive man. So there's just one of him. You know, there he is sitting on his lion skin, playing a didgeridoo, wearing a feather war bonnet or something. Come on. The tribal cultures around the world, they are as different from each other as they are from us.
You're right.
Every one of them is a unique way of being human. And lumping them all together makes it very possible to produce this sort of mishmash. And then when he takes that same consciousness, this same concept, and applies it to Hindu thought, which actually explored the entire issue of figuration and of participation in incredible detail 3,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and he misses that. He misses that completely. So he sees a historically progressive dynamic extending, you know, through all of history from, original participation in prehistoric times to this goal of final participation looming someplace in the future. And I think he's missing the boat because this is not a one-shot thing. This is a cycle that many human cultures have passed through in their own times. It's an important cycle, and he's contributed mightily to understanding it, but in the areas that he knows well. And so Steiner, similarly, I think he would. One of Steiner's problems is that he was working at a time when the understanding of clairvoyant experience, of imaginal experience, the use of the imagination and of thinking as a vehicle for understanding, overemphasized the accuracy of it. People had not yet discovered the hard way that there are additional complexifying factors, things that get in the way of clarity. And so, you know, you look at his version of prehistory, you look at the theosophical version of prehistory, you look at a dozen others, and you can see they're all using the same techniques. They're getting different results. There's a confounding factor here. There's actually a whole bunch of confounding variables here.
That's great.
But living when he did, Steiner didn't know that he had the immense difficulties faced that are faced by any pioneer. And so his work has to be understood with that in mind as a pioneering venture that has to be corrected by later experience. Mm-hmm. And so the evolution of consciousness, the evolution of consciousness is not a linear thing.
Right.
It is, again, Spengler is really good here, where he talks about this cyclical process that he maps on symbolically under the four seasons, that different human societies, different, if you want to be esoteric about it, different groups of souls pass through this sequence at different times.
Oh, just be. Have you read this Gerald Hurd? Again, he's new to me, but
I don't recall the name. I will look him up.
What he is, it's again, it was new, completely new to me. But he was hanging out with like Alan Watts and Huxley out in California.
Mm-hmm.
He's 50 times brighter than either of them combined. So his book, The Five Ages of Man or The Ascent of Humanity. Okay. It's a great use of Spengler. It's not to say I only add that because new to me, I'm sharing my excitement. And,
That's great. I'm not familiar with Hurd, and I will definitely let me make Gerald a note Hurd. Of that name. In fact, Gerald Hurd.
Yep.
Let me grab a notepad, and because since I'm doing this sequence of posts, I want to talk about different ways of understanding the evolution of consciousness. I want to talk about different ways of understanding the way that consciousness moves from this sort of state of enchantment through the state of disenchantment, and then what happens next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting for me, you know, especially what you've written about the occult revival, which kind of blows the myth of disenchantment out of the water, right? Not only
Yeah.
There's, you know, what John Milbank has described as the alternate modernity, which is what I've been writing about for 7 or 8 years. Mm-hmm. And but if you go back to the Theosophist and the early Anthroposophy, right, where mm-hmm. they were drunk on Darwin. They were trying, mm-hmm. they wanted to make an evolutional model that was spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
And which it's nice, but it's hard to swallow, you know. What you're saying with Spengler and with this idea of it's cyclical, and there's a lot of moving parts here. Humanity is not one moving part, and it's not
exactly.
It's not linear,
exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Well, I want to pick up something that you've just said here, because the version of evolution that we saw from the Theosophists, from the early Anthroposophists, we also see in Ken Wilber, because he was heavily influenced by Theosophical thought, is actually pre-Darwinian. that whole idea of evolutionary teleology, of evolution as seeking a goal, as moving through these fixed set of stages, whether those stages are, you know, those of Wilbur spiral dynamics or what have you, that's all pre-Darwinian.
Yeah.
If you actually take Darwin's ideas and apply and think through them, think through their spiritual implications, you actually get something much more complex and much more interesting. But very few people did that. One of the things that I'll be grumbling about in an upcoming post about Barfield, actually, is his rank misunderstanding of Darwin, where he dismisses Darwin as just saying, well, it all happened by random chance. That's not what Darwin is saying. And I would encourage anyone who thinks so to actually pick up a copy of The Origin of Species. It's an easy read. It's worth your while. And, you know, it's not the randomness is the fuel. It's the active thing. There's also receptive factors as well that turn this sort of random churn into movement in various directions. So a lot of people were kind of drunk on, I don't know, near-beer Darwin, fake Darwin, I'm not sure what to call it. But yeah, they were guzzling Darwin light and getting very tipsy on it, and without actually grasping what Darwin was saying. And again, Ken Wilber's still doing that.
Yeah, and it's a direct subject of your most recent blog piece, which again is excellent. And I'll have to not think about it, but I have to like read Darwin. But like when I think of your image, you're describing these rooms, you know, that this randomness is going in, then it seeps through a crack. Mm-hmm. And I really mm-hmm. love that. I guess it's been sitting with me even as I woke up this morning, not in a way to, you know, not in a left brain way, but as an image. But when mm-hmm. if we scale out, because I think scale gets at everything, right? You know, and mm-hmm. if we scale out and that randomness, which we've been so systematically trained to say, like, not that it's relative at all, but it's been so 4 million years. But if we just scale time quicker, it can mm-hmm. look just like the one thing determined the other, you know. So this randomness, or like what certain a view of science that just can prove mm-hmm. everything with, like, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of years. I always just kind of mm-hmm. smell a rat in that. But is that when you do these future blog posts, mm-hmm. is there anything to what I'm saying? You know, I just, you know, randomness.
Yeah, well, randomness on one scale can turn into direction on another.
Yeah.
Dion Fortune, one of the occult teachers whose work has been very central to my work, mm-hmm. Her teacher used to say, God is pressure. What is pressure? Pressure is the random movement of molecules.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and yet it exercises a force in certain directions. You know, that's the pressure that can drive the bubble through the crack under the door, or drive the balloon and inflate all the way down the hall. So yeah, there's you need
is that
to
the goddess Tai Chi in Welsh mythology? Or are we talking about chance here? You know, the goddess chance that we all need to.
The Greek goddess Tai Chi. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. But you know, that's one way of thinking about it. Huh. And exactly, I should say, you know, where the sequence of posts is going, I'm not sure yet. I write as a way of thinking out loud. I write, I will set myself, and I do this with novels, I do this with nonfiction works, I do it with sequence of blogs. Uh-huh. I'll literally kind of set myself a puzzle, set myself a situation, and then start writing about it and thinking about it and reflecting on it, meditating on it, and things tend to unfold right. in various, sometimes very unexpected
ways. You're a real model of that. It's really, it makes you reading you very exciting.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to hear that. But that's always been how I approach this kind of writing project. What I started from, of course, in the current case, you know, we've got Max Weber with his talk about the disenchantment of the world. There was a very interesting recent book by Jason Josephson Storm called The Myth of Disenchantment, where he points out that at the same time that Weber was writing all this stuff about the disenchantment of the world, half the people he knew were practicing occultists.
So funny.
So something weird was going on here. Yeah. And, you know, and so Josephson Storm kind of unpacks all of this cultural setting in, you know, turn of the last century Germany, what was going on, what were the mm-hmm. belief systems who were feeding into this business. And so that just struck me as a fascinating question. And I've been fielding a lot of questions about Wilbur, about Barfield. I also have to address Jean Gebser.
Sure.
Which is where Wilbur got most of his ideas, of course, and away we go. And also, probably, I'm going to have to drag in René Guénon and the traditionalists.
Mm-hmm.
And Gerald Hurd. No, but you're
Gerald, right. Well, Gerald, I'm going to check the local library system and see if they have a copy of the book.
There's an image though that I want to, you know, when you were talking about the occultist right there in Max Weber's friend group, you know, the meme would, the visual would be like Max saying that, you know, we're getting disenchanted, then an image of all these astrologists and things saying, we're right here. You know, we're right here. But your essays are always doing that for me. They're introducing complexity that makes me rethink things.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's, you know, speaking, I mean, because at that time in history, it was that kind of occultism was more mainstream. I remember, Mike, a few years ago, I wrote this blog post on the Oxford Book of Mystical Verse.
I do.
The one that had Crowley's poem in it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Imagine that happening today.
Yeah. And it's got all kinds of people who were Golden Dawn people with in there. William Wilmes Hearst, the Freemason, and all these people you'd never expect, and especially from a, you know, such a mainstream place as Oxford of all places. Well, right?
When you realize that the Oxford University Press, one of their important editors was Charles Williams.
Right.
You know, who was a hardcore Golden Dawny in the Arthur Edward Waite line. Yeah, right. The English culture at that time was crawling with occultists.
Right. And I don't know if you know, in that book, in the Oxford Book of Mystical English Mystical Verse, toward the end, there are maybe four or five poems by Anonymous. They're Charles Williams poems.
Oh, really?
He just didn't put his name to it. Yeah.
He was writing pretty weird stuff under his own name. I wonder what it was about.
Okay. That's fascinating. Okay, I'll definitely check those out. Because Williams was an odd duck, but he's always worth reading.
I have that new biography. Well, it's 5 years old, The Third Inkling by it was good. And there's a Gavin Ashenden who wrote a real good biography of him, who I see on Twitter, an Anglican.
Cool. I will check those out. It's been a while since I've done a hard dive into Charles Williams' stuff.
Yeah,
reread his novels anyway. I've actually just recently launched a new series of occult themed mysteries novels, and so I need to get a sense of what's been done.
If I can take you on a 5-minute detour and we'll go back to things more mystical, but this is mystical, and I did not read A Man in Orange, but most seminal for me, you know, when I look at politics, is just that simple image, and I wish you would share it with our listeners, of Trump as a change figure, you know, because it's still going on today. It doesn't end. You made the case that change figures come up river, and all we know is everything changed, and they can be a buffoon. Can you share with our listeners? Seminal.
Oh yeah, no. This was the one of the core images in my book, The King in Orange. Yeah. And yes, that is a reference to The King in Yellow. And I was writing a whole series of Lovecraft themed fantasy novels at the time, so the imagery just was impossible to avoid. But watching Donald Trump, watching the way that his mere image or name caused people to melt down and go into just total emotional hissy fits right there on the spot. It was weird. And, you know, this sort of boiling irrationality that seized people all around the Trump phenomenon on all sides of the political spectrum. Yeah, what he reminded me of is stories that I learned when I was younger, when I was living in the Puget Sound area, and I was interested in the Native people's legends and the mythology of Puget Sound and the stories that, you know, many of the First Nations in North America have a figure whose role is he's the one who causes change. He's the changer or the transformer. Sometimes it's Coyote, but not always. In Puget Sound, back in the day, in Puget Sound, it's Moon. And there's this long, complicated backstory about his birth and his upbringing and this kind of stuff, as there usually is in a proper mythology. But a lot of the story is how he starts. He comes to the shore and goes up the river. And in the particular version that I learned, it was the Snoqualmie River. And so he's walking up the river, and there's all these beings who are trying to stop him, because they know that he's going to change the world to make it ready for the people who are on their way. And so they'll do all kinds of things to stop him. But, you know, there's the guy who's whittling this wooden board. And so the changer, the moon comes up and says, "Hey, what you doing?" And the guy says, "There's this guy coming who's going to change things. And here's this, I'm making this board. I'm going to hit him over the head with it." And the changer picks up the board, sticks it in the guy's rump and says, "Okay, from now on, your name is Beaver." And when the people come, they'll hunt you for your fur. And he turns into a beaver. And there he is today. The board has become his tail. And then he goes further, and there's this guy on the hill with a couple of these sort of sharp, spiky objects in his hand. And Moon goes, "So who are you? What are you doing?" And the guy says, "This is a guy coming who's going to change things. I made these spiky things. I'm going to hit him with them and kill him." And Moon grabs the spiky thing, sticks him on the head, and says, "From now on, your name is Deer. And when the people come, they'll hunt you for your meat." And he turns into a deer. And, of course, he's still there on the hill. And so on. And the moon goes all the way up the river, to the mountains at the source of the Snoqualmie River, then he jumps in the sky and becomes the moon. And there's more to it. There's much more to it. It's a really beautiful, really deep story. But what I saw was this buffoonish figure, the figure of Donald Trump, the King in Orange, sort of walking his way up the river of America, and people were getting stuck in the same thing. You know, he, from now on, your name is Protester. When the people come, they'll meme you for the loaves. Inevitably, of course, I got accused of being an evil Trumpista or various other things like that, because I didn't simply go around chanting "Orange Man Bad," "Orange Man Bad." But it was fun.
I get the same thing.
Yeah, and it makes him out to be a distinctly American figure, you know? And that, again, he's like Barnum and Bailey, not so much Hitler to me. And he's a Caesar figure, not a Hitler figure. You know, he's a populist figure. And it just clarifies.
Just a moment. Do you think Hitler wasn't popular?
No, he was. For sure,
he was hugely popular. Right. The thing that nobody remembers nowadays is that Hitler was seen by the Germans of the time as young and charismatic and a breath of fresh air. Problem was that the political system had failed completely to come up with any answers for the problems of the time. That's when you get maniacs like Hitler seizing power. And, you know, Trump is not a Hitler. He is, he's a Barnum and Bailey type, but a P.T. Barnum. But he got power precisely because the establishment of our time has completely failed to come up with answers for the problems that are making so many Americans' lives miserable. And until and unless the establishment gets off its precious pink rump and does something about those problems, they're just going to get one charismatic populist after another.
True.
Yeah. It shows how all your work goes together. Your view of history allows you to speak, I think, uniquely to current events and things like that, you know.
Absolutely. Probably the great blind spot of modern times is the insistence that there's nothing to learn from history because, you know, we progressed beyond that. We're making all the same mistakes that failing empires have made over and over again throughout the ages.
Yeah.
And acting as though there's something new. The mess that's going on in Ukraine right now, that same fight was going on between the Romans and the Parthians, 2,000 years ago, and back as far as records go.
I know that Philip Reed has a definition of barbarism in his book, Charisma. Barbarism is not like antiquated cosmologies or old-fashioned timepieces. It's a systematic severing of a people from its history. That's barbarism, right?
That's barbarism. And so, Americans have always been barbarians. The whole point of people coming to the United States was that they could leave their past behind. They could leave their culture behind. The number of people I know whose grandparents, came over here and dropped their language and their culture like a hot rock.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want anything to do with it anymore. And that it was all a memory of poverty and misery and oppression, of class oppression in the old world. They wanted to be free. They wanted the open spaces and the opportunity to make something new of themselves. And so, we're a barbarian culture.
So I always tell I tell students, but I tell my children too, that where we live in Michigan, in fact, right on our land is a Native American burial ground. I think it was probably more a meeting ground than a burial ground. Mm-hmm. And it's been it was excavated in the 1930s. But the point being is that when the French came to this part of Michigan, those mm-hmm. who did, they came to escape all the things you just talked about in Europe. Mm-hmm. But even more than that, those voyageurs came so they could hunt. Mm-hmm. Because in Europe, that's reserved to the nobility.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Every single game animal, every single fish in the streams is owned by somebody. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they come to the New World and to the Midwest where I live, and this is why you see with the French in particular, you see a lot of intermarriage with Native American people mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. they were adapting to the land. I mean, they were. Mm-hmm. Becoming, they were joining the team, right?
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, where yeah. you didn't see that so much with the English, but that's what we what I think when we think of, when we talk about deindustrialization, and mm-hmm. a lot of the people I know, you know, it's really different, you know, having been a college professor and in a very urban environment and being a farmer mm-hmm. now. And most of the people I talk to, all they want to do is talk about hunting or growing things or making cheese or whatever it happens to be. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know,
because these are the things that actually impart value to a human flourishing.
Mm-hmm.
They actually
mm-hmm.
do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, you know, one of the things that we see in this sort of historical cycle that Barfield was talking about, that I'll be talking about in more detail, is precisely this tendency to move from a rural-centered society in which hunting and making cheese are the things that matter to an urban society where you have this buildup of more complicated, you know, mental pyramids. Mm-hmm. And then they get too high and they start coming unglued and it flows back out to the countryside again. Mm-hmm. And there are complicated features in that cycle, and that's something I'll be writing about as we go.
Good.
I'll look forward to it. Yeah.
So I wonder if we can talk about the myth of disenchantment a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So I mentioned the occult revival of the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you see that? Because I see it in certain ways, and I write about it all the time. Where do you see mm-hmm. it right now?
In terms of the legacy of the occult revival, in terms of the myth of disenchantment,
yeah. mm-hmm.
Okay. On the one hand, yeah, we still have that mythology that says that people, you know, way back then believed in magic, and now we know better. No, in fact, probably more than half of the people in the United States today have some personal involvement in occultism, however minor. They have a lucky stone, or they pay attention to a horoscope, or they have some connection to that. The most astonishing number of people, you know, still know how to do certain little spells. Mm-hmm. And yet they all believe, they all have that, you know, that's one thing, but somehow that never affects their, you know, that widespread sense that magic isn't something we do anymore.
Right.
And how that myth is maintained is really complicated. That's something I'm still exploring. In terms of the legacy of the great occult revival that was kickstarted originally by Eliphas Levi in 1854, 1855, with the publication of Doctrine and Ritual of High Magic.
By the way, I love your series on that book.
Thank you. Thank
yeah,
you. That's I'm rather chuffed. The earlier series on Dion Fortune's Cosmic Doctrine, the book version of that will be out in March. So
great.
I am looking forward to turning the Levy series into a book or possibly two books.
Speaking of Dion Fortune, I took a picture of myself taken in front of her house in Glasgow.
Oh, nice. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, 30, I've been to her grave
34 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been to her grave.
Can I nuance this talk of enchantment, thinking out loud, is that if you had, so we have the rationalization of the world, like the industrialization of the world as mm-hmm. machine, man as machine, and I know you're right. I mean, people are doing, so we have stones, and so we have these kind of magical things. In your writing, do you need magic or the touching of stones to be associated with anything otherworldly, you know, because I'm thinking of just the phenomenon of OCD. So in an anxious culture, it's going to produce what I would call religious behavior, but a mechanism science of psychology can talk about that in a way that could bring what we're calling magic still into the realm of science. Am I getting at anything? You know?
Oh yeah. The thing is there's the actual world of practice and behavior and emotion. And then there's the intellectual substructure we raise on that. And one of the lessons of the last century and a half of occultism is that you can build any substructure your heart or superstructure your heart desires on top of these details of practice.
Yeah.
Whether you want to do the very old-fashioned kind of magical thing that focuses on, you know, spirits and so on, whether you want to do the kind of Jungian approach that sees it as archetypal, whether you're doing the chaos magic approach of just seeing it as just patterns in consciousness empowered by the imagination, there, you know, but ultimately the behavior, the practice, the emotions remain the same. And so the superstructures rise up in increasing complexity, and by and large, they also come crashing back down. We are at an interesting point right now because starting at the end of the 1970s, a lot of the heritage of the late 19th, early 20th century occult revival was obscured by the neo-pagan movement. We had all of the people doing the kind of pop Wicca, not old-fashioned trad Wicca, but the sort of thing that Starhawk and Margo Adler and so on, Scott Cunningham, marketed so successfully. And that was really had a dominant position in the collective imagination. And enormous numbers of people, you know, finding out that I was interested in occultism said, "Oh, you're a Wiccan." I'm going, "No, I keep my clothes on in ritual, thank you." and when I did my 12 years as head of a Druid order here in the United States, was constantly having to say, "No, this is Druidry. It is not Wicca. These are our traditions. We don't circle for the Sabbats. We keep our clothes on, etc." And because there was this this sort of paradigm of pop Wicca. That we constantly had to differentiate ourselves from. Yeah. That's failing at this point. The neo-pagan movement is basically over. And I mean, there are still people practicing it, but a lot of the festivals are sharply downgraded or even shut down. The little Wicca stores you had all over the avant-garde neighborhoods in half the cities in North America, those are mostly gone now.
Yeah.
The whole movement is just—it's become mostly a bunch of older people going through, you know, the familiar motions that were really new and exciting when they were 20. And what I've seen in reaction to this is a growing number of people are showing interest in things like the Golden Dawn, things like Martinism, things like, you know, these various things like anthroposophy. You can talk about Rudolf Steiner now. You can talk about biodynamic agriculture. And it's not just, "Well, no, I just want to circle the Sabbats." It's, "Oh, so tell me more." So I think you know, there was this period of this sort of interregnum, the Wiccan interregnum, we can call it. And now there's a renewed interest in a lot of these older things. Ironically, online archives of old occult documents, occult books, and even in some cases like correspondence lessons, are available now, and that's helping to drive the thing because you can get the information easily.
Yeah, that's nice. That's wonderful. Even for me, you know, so my doctorate is in 17th century English literature, and I wanted to study, you know, Robert Flood. I remember when I first started graduate school. I had, there was only one copy of a book by Robert Flood within 500 miles, and I had to go visit. Yeah. And it was like visiting a book in prison, you know.
Right. Oh yeah, yeah.
With the guard. Yeah. But now you can just download all of his books.
Yeah. I mean, I'm funny you should mention that. I'm doing a working translation of the material from Utriusque Cosmi Historia on music theory.
That's a book, boy.
Oh, that is a book. That is an amazing book. But he, you know, among many other things, he covered, he gave a good solid introduction to Renaissance music theory and its connections to, esoteric number theory and sacred geometry. And so, since those latter two are of interest to me, I literally just had to go to archive.org and download my yep. choice of copies to download.
Me too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, exactly. Yeah. There it is.
That's now, this wild. Is interesting. So in my books, which book is it? In The Submerged Reality, I wrote a chapter on Flood, which was wonderful. But mm-hmm. years before that, when I was a Waldorf teacher, in Matrius Quay, Cosmic Historia, that he's got that, the Temple of Music.
Yes.
That, and the great engraving. But there's this little mm-hmm. tiny window in there where he's got some music,
mm-hmm.
like written on a staff. So mm-hmm. I pulled it out and I put it into modern notation, and I had my students play a version of it, which is, and it's beautiful, by the way.
Sweet.
Yeah. I'll see if I can find it and I'll send it to you.
I would love to see that. My wife is a musician. She plays violin and viol, and I would be interested to see how basically how it sounds.
And I can see if I don't know if I have the music where it could have gone to it, but if I find that too, I'll send it to you as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. But the point I'm making is that the point I make in most of my work is that at the time that Flood and Thomas Vaughan
mm-hmm.
and others, you know, at that time were in a way resisting the tidal wave of the scientific revolution, which was starting right then, because they mm-hmm. were resisting that materialist paradigm of things,
mm-hmm.
and they saw mm-hmm. where it would head, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I often mention what would have happened if those guys got all the research money and funding and support instead of the materialists.
Not too late.
No, it's not too late, actually. But no, that's an interesting question. I have an essay in one of my collections of essays that I published in a magazine many, many years ago, talking about the politics behind the mind-body problem, the erasure of the middle ground between mind and body, the erasure of the occult traditions, you know, because it was a very political thing. It had to do with struggles between, you know, this is going to sound almost Marxist, okay, between, on the one hand, the old aristocracy and then the rising mercantile classes, what became the capitalist class, and then you had certain other interests, less organized, that tended to rally around the occult tradition, the chemical philosophy, to use the term of the time, as opposed to the mechanical philosophy. And it is intriguing to think about what might have happened if that had gone the other way. And for whatever reason, the mechanical philosophy had ended up losing that war, and the chemical philosophy, the alchemical would be better, became the paradigm of European culture. Mm-hmm. What would have happened to the world? What would things have been like? And yeah, but you know, as you were saying, it's not too late.
Yeah, it's not too late. and there are,
we've got Flood.
You know, if you look, yeah, through the, you know, the rise of homeopathy, for instance. Which mm-hmm. I was interviewed yesterday with a physicist, and he was fascinated by that, and the notion in homeopathy that if you reduce the physical substance of something, its spiritual power becomes that much more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
If you do it in the right way, mm-hmm. because you've got to have that process of succussion. That this is one of the things that I've been into for a very long time is the offshoot of homeopathy, biochemic medicine that uses the 12 cell salts or tissue salts.
Right.
Mm. And so, yeah, you know, you've got it. You have to. It's not merely the dilution. There's the succussion. There's something going on. We can use, if you want to, the term etheric formative forces.
Right. Exactly what it is.
And of course, that's if you talk to physicists about that in the right way. And they don't just, you know, back away from you making, you know, waving garlic and making the sign of the cross as though you were a vampire. you can actually get a very interesting conversation going. But
it's true. Well, I did have a good conversation going with this guy, and he was not antipathetic to what I had to say. So that was interesting.
Cool.
We can see it also in Goethe. We see it in other places as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that that's in a way you can say that is a. These are streams that kind of arise from the mm-hmm. 17th century Rosicrucianism, right?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. Very much so. Hahnemann, the founder of homeopathy, was although I don't think he talked about this, I believe it's generally held that he was influenced by Paracelsus.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, yeah, you know, you've got that direct connection there. And And the biochemic cell salts, again, were picked up by occultists, especially, but not only in North America. And yeah, there's a lot of connection back and forth here. And I think especially as the really narrowly defined materialist sciences have kind of run their course. Partly they've achieved most of what they can achieve without fantastic expense. Partly we're starting to see a lot of the downsides of, you know, their products are not necessarily working to spec. And they're not working to spec in ways that make sense if approached from a more spiritual scientific
approach. And as I'm sure you've written, I know you've written because I've read it, as we've seen over the last few years, right, when that impulse gets married to corporate and government greed.
Oh yeah,
we're asking for trouble, and the good part about that is it sets the stage for a paradigm shift towards something more humanly scaled, right?
Not Michael, if you could, you know, you have all these different paradigms and the ways of looking at history so far, and so forth. But you, you know, Michael raised the issue, you know, interspersed and at your Dreamwith channel, you know, you had your own story to tell with COVID, which I'm quite sympathetic, by the way. But, you know, because you're a free thinker and you tell it the way you see it, tell us where you think the last 3 years, you know, have left us and where we might be going.
Oh, you like easy, simple, uncontroversial questions.
Well, yeah, I do think you've laid some groundwork, you know.
Exactly. No, my take is that we are seeing a disastrous conjunction of corporate greed, government overreach, and scientific hubris.
Mm-hmm.
And Amen. That the consequence we have on the one hand, a virus that was simply not that dangerous to anybody except the very old or the immunosuppressed. And then we had a vaccine that has a cascade of nasty side effects that how extensive are they? We don't know yet. All we know is that the number of people who show every sign of being severely vaccine injured is mounting up steadily. And they're being gaslit right and left by not only by the government officials and by the pharmaceutical company, but by their own doctors.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And which is just shameful. You know, what I don't know what happened to first do no harm. It apparently has mutated into first follow the party line. Okay. But yeah, so we have a world-class disaster here.
A world-class disaster, right?
Yeah, the impact of the shutdowns on the global economy was horrible. Their impact in human scale, people, especially in the working classes, who were laid off, deprived of income, deprived of any way to support themselves, the rates of suicide, alcoholism, drug overdose as a result of the unnecessary lockdowns, huge. And now we have the consequences from these insufficiently tested, very experimental, very risky vaccines, which, you know, are mounting up. We don't know how bad it's going to get. But I hope this leads people there are two ways it could go, two mm-hmm. bad ways it could go and one good way. And here again, Steiner, this is a bit of useful Steiner, remembering that the good is not the opposite of one bad thing, but the midpoint between two.
Okay.
On the one hand, we could just cover it up and continue with business as usual, in which case we run face first into the next disaster. On the other hand, we could have a big backlash against modern medicine as a whole, throw out the baby with the bathwater, and lose a lot of things that actually help people a great deal. What could happen if we are smart and if we find that middle place between the two dumb ideas is that we can rein in the medical industry and the pharmaceutical industry. We can look at providing a medical system that actually provides basic medical care to most people at a reasonable price, that gets the insane profiteering out of that market. And maintains the good aspects of modern medicine while still opening things up to other modes of healing, which actually are better suited for many of the actual conditions that people suffer. All of those quote, vague psychogenic conditions that doctors used to grumble about so much, you know, they're not vague at all, but they are, if whether they're psychogenic or not, they're deeply tied up with people's emotional and mental states. they can be dealt with much more effectively by alternative healthcare than by the modern pharmaceutical drug them to death model. Mm-hmm. And so we've got the possibility to move in the direction of a synthesis of the best of modern scientific medicine and the best of alternative medicine. Or we could do one of the two extreme moves and be stupid and suffer
and
for it.
Two questions, I guess, or one statement you've written regarding this, and I'm thinking of listeners, is that some people were listening to you and go, yeah, but never going to happen. And you had an essay that mentioned kind of a historical example in our country under the Jackson presidency, of all things. You might know that, again, it's not so pie in the sky. And so answer that, then I want to ask you one more question, or kind of lay the land.
Okay. Real simple. In the early 19th century, right at the beginning of the 19th century, we had in the United States an insanely corrupt medical profession that was incompetent for treating people. They were being a physician was something to do. That you had to go to a university at a time when that was crazy expensive, and you had all these privileges, and your healthcare didn't help people much. It would just bleed them and purge them and this kind of crap. Mm-hmm. Okay, and as a result of the Jacksonian Revolution, as a result of the same transformation of society that changed voting requirements, so you no longer had to own a certain amount of property to vote. The power of the state governments basically stopped enforcing the limit on who could practice medicine, and they basically opened it up to people. You paid a small licensing fee, and you could hang out your shingle. Mm-hmm. And all through the 19th century, as a result, medical care was a free market. People who were incompetent at it generally didn't get business for long because, word gets around of who's good and who's not.
Yeah.
And so most of the really dramatic medical improvements that happened during the 19th century were caused by that free market medical system. And then, of course, in the early to mid-20th century, the AMA got control of it again, shut things down, and we ended up with the same kind of mess that people were in 1810. Yeah. So we simply need to do the same thing. But it can happen. It can happen quite easily. I would encourage people to read up on what happened then and start drafting legislation and talk to especially populist, conservative, free market-oriented legislators. There may be something they can do.
Very good.
You're looking up a question, Mike. I kind of forgot my question. I'm looking at Michael.
No, I wasn't looking up a question. But I think that's, recently on the show, Mike and I had Dr. Ken Thorpe, who is a radiologist, but he over the past 20 years, he's moved into an interesting direction as far as working with structured water and alternative ways to heal. And I know people he's worked with. And also we spoke to a woman just last week. Her name is Mary Walters, who is a healer, not a physician. And she works in a way I think you'd approve, where in fact we brought one of my children to her a few years ago, that she works by intuition, mm-hmm. and just touches a person on the body and sees where things are going wrong, and she finds the same signal in her vast array of homeopathic remedies and herbs and what have you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so the good news is, and I think you're pointing out, is that this exposure of how rotten things are in the system right now, could very well, in the best case scenario, clear the decks and allow, again, this human scaled approach to healing.
Exactly. Getting medicine back to the human scale, getting it out of the hands of vast, toxic, corrupt bureaucracies. Mm-hmm. And the things like the law that they tried to pass in California, which regulates what doctors can say to their patients to make sure they're spouting the right party line, that's obscene.
It is.
Doctors should be allowed to operate, to advise their patients as best they can based on their own knowledge and their knowledge of the patient's condition. And so partly what we need to do is liberate the physicians and the nurses from this bureaucracy. There are plenty of RNs who are perfectly capable. In fact, every RN I've ever met was perfectly capable of diagnosing, prescribing, and treating ordinary conditions. They should be allowed that right. Get rid of the limitation that requires them to always be under a doctor. You know, you want to solve our healthcare crisis. You've done it.
Yeah.
You know,
well, yeah.
If every RN can just simply hang out a shingle under her own name and start taking care of ordinary healthcare situations, referring to the more complex ones up to the doctors, our healthcare crisis is gone in 30 days.
Wow. Right. Well, that's what the metaphysical poet Henry Vaughan, for instance, was a Paracelsian physician and who didn't have a degree, but and it was much more freedom, and he was able to do good work because of it. And but you see the same thing. I mean, that's not just medicine. I mean, in higher education, where I did time for a while, it's also hamstrung by, they call it accreditation there, but also the tenure process. But it's all
Exactly. There's this huge bureaucratic structure designed to get between the simple fact, the simple process whereby somebody who knows something teaches somebody who wants to learn it.
I would say there's no cure for stupidity, but you know, a higher education, you know, or a PhD just fortifies it and makes it more dangerous.
That's right? For sure.
Yeah. Oh, there is a cure for stupidity, unfortunately. That's most of what that's one of the things that Darwin wrote about, and it's rather harsh.
Now, I remembered my question. I think it's interesting, like, because in your blogs and so forth, and you know, and I mentioned this other channel, the Dreamwith channel, you did write and you listened, more importantly, or equally as importantly, about COVID. How, like, there was such a divisive issue, you know, is a like a personal question for me to you. Like, what was your response from the listeners? Did you, you know, there were such strong feelings. Did you lose, you know, fully a third of your listeners, or did you find that people could be persuaded? Tell me something.
Okay. Well, the thing, what I did to, in terms of the COVID discussion, I had one post on the subject in a discussion of the disintegration of the sort of elite managerial class, their position as an elite authority, and that got a certain amount of snarling from people who don't normally post there, and that they and some concern trolls and people like that. What I did in the case of my Dreamwith journal was I posted, here is my hypothesis. I'm not saying this is the truth. This is what it looks like to me. And that got, like, I forget how many hundred comments. People were really interested because I was striking middle ground. I was not saying, you know, trust your doctor is God, trust him blindly. I was not saying, you know, your doctor is an agent of the evil lizard beings from Alpha Draconis and is, you know, planning to rule the world. I'm saying ordinary human greed, arrogance, and stupidity seems to be on display here. Mm-hmm. People wanted to talk about that. So what I've done ever since is simply I've had a space. I've had a weekly post for discussion, and I don't actually say much on that. I just give people a place to talk, and I enforce a courtesy rule. So when people come wading in to start yelling, they simply get deleted. And I have some other strict controls, you know, keeping the trolls at bay, keeping the rental trolls at bay, and some of these other things, and saying if you want to talk about conspiracies, there's 100 other places you can go. If you want to spout the official party line of the government and the medical profession, there's 10,000 places you can go. That's not what we're talking about here. And people adore it.
Yeah, good.
I have yet to have a week's conversation there that had less than about 250 comments, and many of them mount up into the umpty-ump hundreds. I think I've gotten into four figures once or twice in a week. And it's lively. Yeah, and people are talking about all kinds of different aspects of it. And so I just hold the space for them.
Mm-hmm. Really cool.
I mean, everyone has a pretty good idea what my feelings are on the matter. I don't use mainstream medicine. Uh-huh. There are personal reasons for that as well as theoretical ones. And I also have when the authorities are all whining about how nobody trusts us anymore, my response is, well, yes, you lie too often.
There's a reason for that.
This is very straightforward. If you want people to trust you, stop lying like dogs.
Yeah.
Okay. And but somehow they don't want to hear that. But so people know where I stand, but I don't particularly push my view. I just let people know what I think, and then just hold a space for certain conversations to happen. Great. And far from losing readership, I've gained.
Hmm. Congratulations on that. Yeah, because I
thank you.
It's a model of the way to do it.
It's certainly one way that seems to work, and it's one of the things that I have noticed about myself is that when I break the rules, the way you're supposed to do things, it usually works well.
Hmm.
When I started blogging back in the Archdruid Report, you're supposed to make it short and snappy and have lots of images and blah blah blah, and I was doing these teal deer, 3,000-word essays
mm-hmm.
on long, intricate subjects. And I developed a crazy fan following.
Yeah.
And so basically everything that I've done throughout my writing career, as long as I ignore the conventional wisdom and do the opposite, I do just fine. Draw your own conclusions.
Yeah. I hope young people are listening. Sage advice.
All right. One last question.
Mm-hmm.
It's an astrology question.
Mm-hmm.
All the planets are direct for a change.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your take?
Retrogrades are so overblown.
Yeah.
My take on astrology is derived very much from the late 19th and early 20th century versions. Alan Leo, Llewellyn George, Ivy Goldstein Jacobson,
oh, yeah.
These are the figures that I've studied very closely.
Yeah.
To them, the retrograde is just one more debility. It's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Yeah. It is not the end of the world, and the fact that all the planets are direct means that all the planets lack that one debility. Plenty of them have debilities of their own. I mean, Uranus is still slogging through his fall in Taurus, and until that ends, it's going to be a rough time. And so, you know,
how long is that?
I'd have to look it up.
Okay.
It takes a while.
Uranus takes 84 years to go around this, so it's a 7 year. It's roughly 7 years per sign, and I think it's going to be sometime next year before he finally wanders on into Gemini and starts making communication really interesting.
Yeah, that's when the internet goes down, but.
Always a possibility.
That's great. Well, John Michael Greer, we want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. This has been a really nourishing conversation for me in particular, and I know our listeners will derive a lot of pleasure.
And can you direct people to your work, you know, in your own language?
My blog is ecosophia.net, ecosophia.net. My journal that gets posted every Wednesday. My Dreamwidth journal is ecosophia.dreamwidth.org. You can find my books on bookshop.org. That's my preferred internet provider. Or better still, check out your local full service bookstore and ask them to order things if they don't have them. They would love to hear from you.
Yeah, nice.
My favorite series, and I'm forgetting the one name, but the Pepe the Frog, the Keck Wars, I guess, the Port series.
Oh, you like the Keck Wars. Yeah, that was
people fun. Wanted to dive into your work, you know, and then let's say they're the ages between like 16 and maybe 25. Mm-hmm. I was saying like, how to get a flavor for your specific, unique.
Yes.
That's a four-part
yes.
series.
Look up the phrase Keck Wars. On the other hand, all that material turned into was some of the raw material I put into my book, The King in Orange,
right,
which is
right.
still very much in print.
Good.
So you can get it in book form. You can get it online. I'm around. I can be found.
That's great.
And I have a commercial before we leave.
Go ahead.
I want people to know I am giving an online course. It starts next Saturday, Shakespeare, Magic, and Religion. And
sweet.
If you want to find out about that, you can go to the Center for Creative Studies.com. Get the tab for the Hedge School, and you'll find out all you need to
know. Mike, you said the Center for Creative Studies, or is it the Center?
Did I say creative?
Yeah.
Oh, the Center for Sociological Studies. The Center for
Sociological Studies. Yeah.
I didn't even know where I work. Yeah.
Oh, I'm glad I could save you that. You can send me about a $50 deposit for saving.
Center for Sociological Studies.
Yeah. Okay. People can sign up.
Studies. Yeah.
Sounds great. And so, John Michael Greer, can't thank you enough. You're an insight palooza. And I look forward to following this series on the reenchantment, and we hope to have you on again sometime.
I will look forward. Thank you very much for having me on. I'm enjoying it.
Thanks.